The Atlanta Film Festival doesn't just recognize new work. It also pays tribute to cinema classics. Yesterday, festival goers caught a special 25th anniversary screening of the movie Fried Green Tomatoes. The film stars Kathy Bates, Jessica Tandy, Mary Louise Parker, and Mary Stuart Masterson. It's set in rural Alabama, but Fried Green Tomatoes was filmed in Juliet, Georgia, just north of Macon. Here to talk about the film's legacy is its director, John Avnet. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
25 years, does that seem like a long time, or does it seem just a hop, skip, and a jump away?
Both.
It feels both at the same time.
Well, alternately, because some of the memories are very vivid, and when I see, like, Kathy Bates or Mary Louise Parker, it feels very present. At other times, a lot has happened since then.
You know, one of the things that a lot of critics pointed to was the fact that the book made the relationship, the romantic relationship between the two central characters, very explicit. You chose not to do that. And what I find interesting is that while critics pointed to that and said that was a failure of the movie in some ways, it still got an award from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation for the best feature film with lesbian content. What was your reaction to the sort of the two dual interpretations?
Well, the dichotomy has a lot to do with point of view. First of all, it's inaccurate to say the book was more demonstrative in terms of the relationship. Actually, if you look at it, it was less demonstrative. There was just one particular line, which was not as strong as what was said in the film. In the film, when Mary Louise Parker was on the stand, she says, "She's my best friend and I love her." And I think a lot of people had political intentions in what they wrote, and they were writing about a world that they knew very little about. The customs and behavior in different parts of the country have been different over time. And a lot of times, women have had many different kinds of relationships. And the drawing of what becomes a gay relationship is a definition that when the film came out was different than it is today. I think people look at gender fluidity in a much more sophisticated and realistic way. At the time, you were either A or B. I don't find that to be the truth. And so I feel that a lot of what was written about it was really naive and incorrect. What was important to me in doing the movie was that we could explore relationships between women, all forms of relationships, and explore intimacy between women. And this was not something that was commonplace at the time. Actually, it's not even that commonplace now.
Yeah.
And that was my goal. That's what moved me. And I believe that's what moved an audience. And it's also why it traveled between both gay audiences and straight audiences. That was something, you know, I didn't think about. I was just hopeful that it would be moving. And I think to a greater extent, it was.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you're just joining us, my guest is filmmaker John Avnet. He directed the 1991 movie Fried Green Tomatoes. It was shown at this year's Atlanta Film Festival for its 25th anniversary. He's also directed a number of other movies, including The War and Up Close and Personal. He was executive producer of The Black Swan. And this was one of the first big kind of breakthrough roles for Kathy Bates. What did you see in her or like in her that let you choose her to star in this film?
Well, I wouldn't use the word like. I would use another four-letter word, and it would be love. She's just a phenomenal actress who I'd seen a number of times on Broadway and was very, very happy to have the opportunity to bring her to screen on a couple of movies, including Men Don't Leave. And I was just imagining her and Jessica Tandy for the roles that they played in Fried Green Tomatoes. She's just a flawless, truthful actress and also has deep Southern roots, which I think was quite important for this movie.
I wanted to play a little clip here because this was one of my favorite moments, actually, in the film. This is in the scene in which Evelyn is Kathy Bates' character, and she's talking to her husband, and she's told him that she plans to bring Mrs. Threadgood in to move in with them in their home.
It's never going to happen, so just forget about it.
Don't you ever say never to me. Someone helped put a mirror up in front of my face. And I didn't like what I saw one bit. And you know what I did? I changed. And that someone was Mrs. Threadgood. She needs my love and care now, and I'm going to give it to her.
So this was not, you know, growing up in the Los Angeles area for me, this was not my image of the Southern woman. And I wonder how you felt about these particular moments, these moments in which Fanny Flagg, who ended up writing a large portion of the script for you, was herself flouting Southern stereotype.
First of all, Fanny and Carol Sobieski, who were the credited writers, wrote a bit of it. I wrote most of it. I was not credited. So a lot of those, all those words are my words.
Really?
So, oh, yes. And by the way, it was a bit of a contentious thing. But if you ask Fanny, are you looking, you know, a number of things she said, she's been very, very generous about that after the fact. But what the story was about was the power of storytelling and how it could affect people. And particularly, obviously, it was Kathy Bates' character. And in many ways, it was, to a lot of New Yorkers, very behind the times. And in some ways, many people in the South were a little slower to adopt things. But it is naive, it is simplistic, and it is degrading to describe Southern women as less than anybody else. And that was something that really annoyed me. And the way that Kathy grew and how she grew was endemic to her character. And her character can't be delinked from her upbringing and being part of the South. But there's a power to Southern women. There's always been a power to Southern women. And to say anything else is just ridiculous. So for me, you know, to see her bloom, to see her blossom, to see her love come and turn into action, not just words, within the context of a relationship that was, you know, to some extent prototypical or archetypal, that was exciting. That was fun. And Kathy really went with it. And I loved when she said to Ed, you're trying to kill me. She says, if I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands.
What the hell is this?
That's a low cholesterol meal. Happy Valentine's.
God, are you trying to kill me?
If I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands. Stop in the name of love.
So the anger that she was feeling is part of being liberated. And I think this is a story of her being liberated by these two women who she's learning about.
Since you brought up Carol Sobieski, I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I understand that the first sort of draft she brought to you was a musical.
Yes. Carol was a brilliant writer and a wonderful woman. And she was my first choice to adapt this. And she was really enamored with The Singing Detective, which was a wonderful piece by Porter in BBC put on. And I told her what I wanted, and she said, look, John, I really get it. Would you let me do my version first, and then I'll do whatever you want? Literally, I will do whatever you want. Well, she wrote this, you know, musical where the past and the present, they were all singing together and getting together in the nursing home, and it was wonderful. It just wasn't the movie that I was going to make. I asked her if she would now, you know, honor what she said. She did. She took a shot at it. And then very honestly and very openly and very, in a very emotional way, she said, John, either you should write this or Fanny should write this. I'm the wrong person for this. And volunteered not to continue to be paid and actually said she didn't want credit. Of course, she passed away before the movie came out, and that became moot. But she was a classy woman, very, very talented, and I thought incredibly honorable.
Frank Bennett won't be bothering you no more. You understand?
You killed him.
No. You don't believe me. Right now, I don't know what to believe.
The movie actually is sort of structured around this story of the murder of Ruth's abusive husband. His name is Frank Bennett. And I want to play a clip from the film. This is when the sheriff goes to the Whistle Stop Cafe, and he's...
You ain't fooling me, girly girl?
Yeah, exactly. Let's take a listen.
What we talking about is murder here. Running afoul of the law, and don't nobody get away with that. Not even a bunch of Alabama smart alecks. If I find so much as a half his head, I'll arrest you fast and you can slap a tick. Because I'm the law, and you can't beat the law.
You're laughing. Why does that make you laugh?
I love Rainer Schein, and I love his accent. I mean, one of the things I really enjoyed, I love the Southern voice. I just love it. And I spent quite a bit of time listening and trying to study to get a sense of, you know, where people were from and what the roots might be. But mostly it's the music of it. And boy, he is musical. And so I love that. I just love that scene. You ain't fooling me, girly girl. I know who you are. Yeah, he was great.
Although I just talked to Jack McBrayer, who introduced the film at the Atlanta Film Festival, and he has a very recognizable Georgia accent, says he can't get any work in the state.
Well, he should wait for me to show up, because I love the sound of the voice in Georgia and Alabama. It's a little different in some of the deeper southern areas than the northern part of Georgia, Tate and up there. But it's quite interesting, the whatever the etymology of the voice is. Something I'm not an expert in, but something I enjoy listening to very much.
It's interesting to hear you say that, though, because the thing I hear most often, especially from people working in Hollywood and in the movie business, is that when you use a southern accent, it's most often assumed that person is dumb.
You know, those people didn't see the Watergate hearings and haven't been cross-examined by a southern lawyer recently. I would posit that behind some of that local quality is a rare and very incisive intelligence, as well as, you know, a kind of what I would say being a little bit more at one with nature than people who are city folk. Part of what I love being down south, with many things, but there seems to be an ability to enjoy life. And to understand that there were rhythms to it. And it was something that actually touched me and made me ask questions about my own existence, which were more citified, I think is the word Fanny would use.
I wonder how it changed your filming that you were able to completely design. Again, these are all things I've just read from different coverage of the movie, but I'm told that when your production designer found the Whistle Stop Cafe, it was not a cafe, it was an antique store, and you got to build that horseshoe shaped counter specifically
Yes.
because it was better for filming, right?
Yes. Barbara Lang was the production designer, and when she brought me to Juliet, which was like a ghost town covered in kudzu, very few people, this antique shop, which I was told was open 1 hour a week, was situated in a way that it had a view of a railroad track that was only being used to bring coal down to the power plant. And I had hoped I could convince the powers that be that I could put a period locomotive on there. That was a long, long story and very difficult to do. But with the, approval of the various federal agencies and the railroad agencies, and when we had our railroad man there, Sid, we were able to do it. So it had a great view because back then we didn't have CGI. So putting a train next to the
interesting.
Whistle stop.
Think about that.
And when you think whistle stop comes from, the whistle. Right,
the train whistle.
Exactly. And by the way, we also found the depot in the woods with trees growing through it, and my Georgia boys from Macon, the Grips, cut down the trees, built a little road, and they rolled the thing, put it up by the tracks.
You're kidding me. That building was original.
That building was original. I mean, obviously, we redid it, restructured it, and so on and so forth, but it was original, and we put it where it was. And then in terms of the design of the cafe, again, Barbara was a very talented designer, wonderful collaborator, just a very talented woman. She showed me that horseshoe design, and I went, do it. Let's do it. Because it gave me the ability, one, to see the tracks. Also, I could see out back where Smokey Lonesome would be with Mary Stuart Masterson when he was having the shakes. And you could also see Cicely Tyson, who's a big part of this movie to me, poking her head in and out of the kitchen there with George, Big George. And it just created a world. And we were also able to, use, a lot of elements. Like we had these amber shades in there that gave a real color, a warmth to the place, which could be pulled up or pulled down. And one of the key images to me was the sort of that gunshot through the window, that yeah. Spidering of the glass. And if you actually look at the movie in terms of telling the story visually, the first time you see it, you see a spider, then you see the window being painted with fried green tomatoes served hot at the Whistle Stop Cafe. And then you see the night when the Klan shows up and they blow out the window. And you could tell the story in many ways visually just through that image. And, again, a lot of this was Barbara's imagination. She actually showed me a shot of the spidered glass for no purpose at all. And I went, oh, I like that. I like that. I can use that.
So we're 25 years on, and people are still going to see this movie. Clearly, they just did. I wonder what you hope the movie's legacy will be.
Well, I at this point or when I made it?
Well, let's hear both.
Well, when I made it, I was, you know, I'm a sort of not closeted feminist. You know, I had done in 1984 The Burning Bed, you know, with Farrah Fawcett. That was about domestic violence. And it was an important movie to me and an important movie, much more importantly, to many women who were battered.
And the Fragrant Tomatoes is also about domestic violence.
Yes, that is a theme that you will see in my pieces, and you will see more coming up. Because I just hate it. I just really despise the fact that, women historically started out as chattel, I can't pronounce it properly, but were enslaved, and, you know, the fact that violence was used against them just is obscene. So at any rate, you know, this was yet another opportunity to tell a story that had an element of that. So what I wanted to get across, as I said before briefly, was I was so interested in why so many women are closer to women than to the men that they're married with or their fathers or their children, you know, and whether they were gay or straight. That seemed to be something that was worth exploring. It was and is a phenomenon that I don't think a lot of people have written about in ways that have really moved me or educated me. So that's what I wanted to explore.
I've been thinking maybe I should move on because of Frank and all. I just don't want you to feel like you have to look out for us. I just don't want to be selfish, that's all. Maybe if I wasn't here, you'd settle down.
I'm as settled as I ever hoped to be.
Something happened after the movie came out. Many people wrote a lot of things, and I read as much as I could because I wanted to learn from it. But about 6 months after the movie came out, a young girl, about 10 years old, whose mother was a professor at Cal State Fullerton, I believe, really liked the movie, and she kept asking her mother to see it again and again. The mother said, why? The young girl said, because it's good. And the mother said, well, what's it about? And she said, it's how we tell stories to keep people we love alive. And I went, oh, that's what I was doing. I needed a 10-year-old girl to tell me what I was doing. And that is true for the movie and probably true in my life for people who I care about who've passed away and, you know, and who are influences in me. And I've always felt that on a certain level, I'm an extremely fortunate person that I get to tell certain kinds of stories that not everybody else gets the opportunity to do. And on a certain level, it's almost like the people who want to tell those stories pass the torch from one to another. And one may be Fried Green Tomatoes, another may be another story that's deeply moving and that really explores something about the human spirit that's both truthful and uplifting. Because it's very easy to tear things down. It's much harder to find that which really is moving and ennobling. And that was, I think, what I was interested in exploring. At this point now, you know, I'm very, very pleased, obviously, that the film has, I think, aged well, and people refer to it quite frequently. And I would like to see, personally, I'd like to see more films that explore female relationships of all forms being made. And I've spent a lot of effort and time trying to help other young women or older women, you know, have the opportunity to do that, because I think that having more female voices or more stories about women can't be bad for us. We need it. We need more diverse voices.
Well, you'll hear no argument on that from me. I'm speaking with filmmaker John Avnet. He directed the movie Fried Green Tomatoes back in 1991. The film is 25 years old now, and it was screened yesterday at the Atlanta Film Festival. John, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Thank you.
Now, before I let John Avnet go, I had to ask him about the first time he ate a fried green tomato, and here's what he said.
At a restaurant called Crossroads in Georgia, I had my first fried green tomatoes, and it was good.
Yeah.
And since, I have had quite a bit all over the world. Most of the time, I have not been disappointed, although I have to say I have a fondness for many of the dishes I have received and masticated well down south. It's great.
Do you eat it with hot sauce or without?
Generally speaking, I like it naked. But I, you know, again, I've tried it a lot of different ways. And by the way, I'm kind of partial to fried okra, too. I was thinking of that as the sequel to the movie.
Filmmaker John Avnet, his movie Fried Green Tomatoes celebrates 25 years this year. What's your favorite movie set in the South? You can tell us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk.